Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We are here in Abu Dhabi with Matthew Fitzpatrick. Matthew, what's going on?
Not much.
Do you go? Is it Matthew 100% of the time? Do you go?
No, Matt.
You go by Matt?
Yeah, definitely.
Like formally in tournaments, definitely. Do you go Matthew?
Matt. No. Matt. You're Matthew Matt. If I'm in trouble with my mom. Yeah.
So you're here in Abu Dhabi. You've been coming here for a while. What do you look forward to when you come to this part of the world for golf?
It's mainly the weather. You know, it's pretty still. There's not that much wind. The sun is always out. You know, it's good temperature. It's pretty much like the perfect place for golf. I know everyone says Palm Springs in the States is like probably similar. So, but that's what it feels like when it comes here. Everything's in great shape and yeah, that's the main thing. You know, you get 2 weeks of good weather.
A lot of English people come to the UAE in general. Yeah. We were on a tour last night. It was like four British girls. Like,
oh, really?
So, yeah, it was like, yeah, it's a quick 7-hour flight. I was like,
yeah.
That's not that close.
Well, but that's the thing. Like, I don't know whether the flights are cheap or what, but I know there's a lot of British people out here. I've got a few friends that work out here and stuff, so.
What do you remember about like the first time you came here? Was there much culture shock or is it?
It's funny. I actually came here on holiday with my parents in about, I think it was like 2004. And I mean, it was just desert and no buildings. And I mean, we were in Dubai, not Abu Dhabi. But like literally you had to get a car everywhere. You couldn't walk anywhere. There was nowhere really to go. We just went to this place called Dubai Creek. We mainly went there for dinner because there was like nothing else going on, you know, eating in the hotel and it was just literally desert.
So you've seen kind of the progression.
Yeah, really. I mean, I didn't remember much from 2004, but like when I first came back again in about, I think it was 2014, end of 2014, it was just, you know, it just changed massively, so.
What do you do? Are you social during a week like this? Do you do like any cultural things? What do you eat when you come here? Nothing.
No, I'm terrible.
Are just terrible. Stick to the hotel.
Yeah, I'm terrible. I mean, like a place like this, it doesn't. You know, I wouldn't really. I wouldn't know where to start culturally. I mean, obviously there's the mosque and stuff, which is pretty cool. But a place like this, I wouldn't. But you know, if I was in Paris, I'd probably go out. You know, or Czech Republic is pretty cool as well. So.
Prague, right?
Yeah,
that's Prague. A good place to go out.
Yeah,
what do you do? What is? How are things different like this week on tour to compare to a normal European tour stop? There's not really a normal European tour.
No,
stop.
There isn't. Yeah. There isn't. I don't know how many you've been to, but this is like pretty out of the norm though as well. You know, you can't walk anywhere. You can't just like leave the hotel and go for dinner. You got to get a taxi or you eat in the hotel. That's probably the biggest thing is literally you can't just like walk down the street to a restaurant. It's a 10-minute cab ride to a bunch of restaurants or another hotel, you know, for dinner.
That's what we were really interested to come out here just because we'd never been to the Middle East one. And it's kind of turned into such a golfing hub.
Like
one of the corners of the world when it comes to golf and kind of just curious to see how things go out here. But I want to get kind of talk a lot of things with you. Want to get into kind of your background and stuff, but I used to live in Chicago, so I'm curious about your Northwestern days.
Cool.
What were you? Did you just party too hard one quarter in Northwestern? You were
I
out
wish
of there?
I was that much of a party animal, but I'm really not. I loved it. The school was just too difficult. Like it
really?
Was just too difficult.
That's
I mean,
what it was?
Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna be honest. I didn't really get in off my brains. You know, it was definitely more golfing ability that got me in. So. I loved playing for Coach Goss, I guess, in and David Ingles there. It was great while I was there, you know, and I made some great friends. Like you've probably seen social media, I've been back a ton to see all those guys while they were still in college. And Chicago as a city is awesome as well. So
I figured it was just like way too cold, and you saw the winter too. For the first time, and
yeah,
you were out
that too. I picked a great time to leave, literally that. the January after was the record lows. Like, it was ridiculous. So
Siberia.
Yeah.
So how'd you get to Northwestern in the first place? What drew you?
A couple of mainly good academics. My dad was always sort of like, get a degree, something to fall back on if the golf doesn't work out. And then the other thing was Pat himself, Pat Goss. So I knew obviously Coach Luke, and he was a good golf coach, and I knew my coaches, Mike Walker and Pete Cowan, knew him. They spoke highly of him in terms of he knew what he was doing. You know, I know a lot of these coaches are sort of tend to be more managers than actual swing coaches. So I felt it was a good thing to have that if I was really struggling. And to be honest, like I had a little bit of interest from a few others, but not
you were
masses.
Kind of an unknown coming from.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And then all of a sudden I won the British Boys, which is like US Junior Am, and all of a sudden Stanford are in touch and Cal Berkeley are in touch, and yeah, all these other schools have suddenly got in touch, and by that point it was too late. I was just about to sign for.
Was your dad like crushed when you were like, "Hey, I don't really want to do this"?
Yeah, I think a little bit. He's always been. They've always been great. My mom and dad are like really supportive in whatever I do. But that was the big thing. I think the good thing was Mike and Pete persuaded him that they said I was good enough to make it. So I think they sold it to him that it was kind of gonna be all right. So
did you have an oh shit moment like along the way, like your first midterm or your first?
Yes, many a times. Yeah, many a times. Like my current girlfriend, I met her there obviously, and we were in the same intro to psych class, and it was like my student advisor was like, "Yeah, this is a great class to get you started. You know, it's pretty basic, you know, mm-hmm. you'll get going." And like, first few lectures, I sort of kind of got the gist of what was going on. And then literally was like, "Yeah, this is what you need to study." And like, I'm studying with my girlfriend and I'm like, what? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Nothing going in, nothing at all. I'm reading note after note, nothing's going in. And then we take this test and I was just like, I have no idea. And then I can't even remember my grades after the first.
How many tournaments did you play in that semester?
Play five.
Five. Yeah, okay. Five. So that's a lot of travel.
So it was
too.
Good. Yeah.
That's a big.
Yeah.
That's a big adjustment.
But we actually it was kind of good though in a way. Where did we play? Play Olympia Fields, which is only an hour away, and then we played our home tournament. So two of those were like.
And then your home course at Northwestern was what?
A mix. It was actually, it's called the Glen Club where the main practice facility is, but I mean, we played North Shore, Lakeshore, where else? Lots of different places, basically.
There's too much good golf.
Yeah, there is quite a bit.
So what was the timeline for when you committed to Northwestern? You won the USAM in 13,
yeah,
right? And then you went to school that fall. Had you already committed to Northwestern like way in advance of that? Did the US amateur win change kind of your career path?
Yeah, this is really bad, but like I didn't really know much about the US amateur in a way. Like my dad is like a golf perf, really, like that's the best way of putting it. You know, he knows everything about the amateur game, the professional game, knows all how to work out world rankings, you name it. So like he entered me and he's like, you know, we'll go, it's in Boston, great city, great experience, and then we'll have like 4 days in New York at the end. You know, you might not get through the stroke play, no joke this either, and we'll take it from there anyway. Obviously managed to get through, kept on going all right, and managed to win the thing. So it was a little bit from left field.
Unexpected,
and then exactly, and then played World Cup, go to school, and it all happened really fast because I never really got a week at home almost before I went to Walker Cup to really sort of get to grips with what's going on. But it wasn't enough, really. I didn't, you know, it just happened, and I was just there, and I was just thrown right in. So it was probably a good thing in a way, so I wasn't like not really sure about this anymore. But
that's a pretty crazy course to kind of win sight unseen. I lived in Boston for the last 2 years.
Oh nice.
And I was lucky enough to go out there one day, and just I was so blown away at how small the greens are.
Yeah.
There, I mean, it suits your game.
Yeah,
very well.
I mean, it was that week. The condition was awesome. Just fairways, pure like tight fairways, and then the greens were firm, fast. Miss the green, tough up and down. Mm-hmm. Miss it on the wrong side, like you're dead. It's
anybody that you went up against in match play that has kind of made it onto the world stage, or are they still kind of trickling through?
In my whole amateur stuff,
just in that USAM.
That USAM. Yeah. Not that I went up against, I don't think. I know I played Gavin Hall,
okay,
who played for Texas, mm-hmm, and he won the junior players like quite a few years before that. And I remember he won it by like 5, and he hit it so far. It was unbelievable. Like 30 by me, I was like 17 or something. So when I got drawn against him, I was sort of like, this kid's really good, you know. See, but just wasn't his course. Like, you know, it was tight, and I just ended up holding every single putt I looked at, so it kind of helped me along the way.
So Walker Cup 2013, we wanted to ask about National Golf Links.
Okay.
What was it like to compete like on such an amazingly historic course?
Yeah.
Did you have an appreciation for it at the time, or do you?
Not really. I have now. I'm lucky enough, I've got two really good family friends that are members there. So I've played it quite a bit since. Had the special lunch there that they call, so they love that. Ted actually says that, Ted, my manager, actually said that they bring out lobsters like bread rolls, which is crazy. So, but no, I mean, like, to play with your friends, I think it's a fantastic golf course. You know, you're always in the hole. You're never really going to lose a ball. Some funky greens, but like, it kind of let me down as a competition course, because I just felt like it was, you could just smash it, mm-hmm, long and far.
Technology is not
yeah, exactly, you know, you could do it and anywhere, you know, you go hit it wide, and that was sort of helpful for those guys, because they were just bigger and longer than us.
Yeah, another topic so, we wanted to discuss with you, like, kind of you're what, you're 5'10", 155,
yeah,
160.
I don't know.
No,
that's pounds.
That's pounds. That's right. Just kind of being one of the guys on tour that isn't like known as a bomber.
Yeah.
Is there a big difference between European tour and PGA tour setups in that regard? And do you truly feel like you're at a disadvantage when you do tee it up against those bombers?
I think so. You know, I think like I'm big into statistics and everything and all the strokes gained stuff, and I think that's one thing that, you know, there's absolutely such an advantage by hitting it 320 through the air like Rory and DJ and John Rahm and all those guys, and there is no doubt about that. There's a massive advantage, but I did some work towards the end of the year where putting together some form of a bit of a chart on the difference between fairways hit and missing, and, you know, I tried sort of PGA and Bridgestone time to move the ball up and try and get a little bit more carry, which I did, and I was carrying it 10-15 yards further just by doing that and changing shaft, but it was going left, right, everywhere, you know, it was really bad. So we sort of sat down after that with my team and sort of worked out this chart on sort of fairways hit rather than length. Did that at the back end of the year and had like eight top 15s in a row. Yeah, so
so just looking at that, I was gonna ask about the Omega European Masters, just because that looks like yeah, you win cool tournaments, man.
Thank you. Yeah,
you got that one, you've got the Nordea, you've got the AM at the golf club or at the country club, okay, and then really, you kind of sold your performance short at National Golf Links too.
Yeah,
I think you went 3-1.
Yeah, yeah, I know. wasn't. Yeah,
but yeah. So I mean, it was pretty quick results.
Yeah,
after switching things back.
Yeah,
then and you just and it was literally just ball position.
Yeah, I mean, what was funny, like growing up where I played at Hallamshire Golf, like it was just always windy, always hilly, you know. So I always had to keep it down, like lots of back foot shots, and my attack angle just naturally was probably with driver. It was like 4 or 5 on the down. So it's something we've always looked at and sort of kept an eye on. And then literally I did probably a month of moving it up, just literally keeping it up and hitting up on it. And then all of a sudden it went from like minus five to plus five. So obviously that's stupidly drastic.
One extreme to the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's stupidly drastic. But then when we just sort of said, right, well, just go what feels comfortable, I did that. And like it obviously somehow averaged out then at like plus one, which is great because now that's a pretty decent attack angle and you can obviously increase that and it still feels pretty natural to me. So.
Yeah. So going back to just looking at, you seem to play really well at Augusta too, minus the second round.
Yeah.
Looks like second round's kind of had your number, but otherwise you've been right in the mix.
Yeah, I love the place. You know, like I've spent a ton of time there. Obviously, when I got the chance as an amateur and then first year as a pro and last year, I just think it's a place where we're so lucky to get invited and go and play. You know, you've got to make the most of it. I know guys that have...
So when you played as an amateur, did you stay in the Crow's Nest?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you did one night. Okay. I only did one night, yeah. Okay. So that was fun.
And then had you seen it prior to showing up on Sunday or Monday, or
of the tournament as an amateur week? Yeah, I went like 2 weeks before.
Okay.
Yeah, and spent like 4 days in a row.
It's drastically different then. Yeah. Right,
I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like I played again last year. I went and played the Saturday Sunday and they'd had a bad storm. It was really wet, the greens were soaked, spinning back and everything. You turn up Thursday morning, it's just like pitching on this table. Yeah. So
and then so going back to your kind of that charting the statistics, you found that there was enough of an advantage to be had by hitting fairways.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to this stats guy that I actually met who works for sort of TaylorMade, and basically the average fairway hit, you get in 10 to 15 yards extra roll. So have that and then two extra fairways, it equated to like two extra fairways on top of what you already hit. It was like a gain of 1.3, which I was like averaging minus 0.something.
And okay. Was it different on the Euro Tour versus the PGA Tour? Like, was there a disparity between it being more advantageous to hit fairways on one or the other?
No, well, it was kind of the back end of the year, so I've not really seen the
big
proof.
Enough
yeah,
size,
I've
yeah.
not seen the proof yet, but I know playing the USPGA, well, at Quail Hollow this year, last year was absolutely brutal. So.
Was so I remember it was actually last summer in Scotland. I remember seeing you, I forget the name of the restaurant, I want to say like Lido or something like that. I remember seeing you walk out of the restaurant carrying your TrackMan. So is that thing just with
really?
You?
Where was Scottish Open?
I think it was in it was at Dundonald, so we were in near Troon. It was like somewhere.
Yeah. I heard maybe
DJ was tight with his TrackMan, but that's like next level.
I think I tried to. Yeah. I was laughing. So
yeah.
Hard.
Well,
like,
to be fair though, we've had some bad instances with my TrackMan.
Yeah.
Like it has been left in some terrible places. Like the one most recently, like was South Africa. It was Joburg Airport. Like Joburg's not like the safest place.
Right.
Everyone knows that. And I checked in, and that was in like a separate hand luggage piece, and literally me and Ted are just walking to dinner like, yeah, let's just go get some dinner. And then I get there and I've just gone, oh shit. And like literally I'm sprinting back there because I mean it could be gone, you don't know.
Those are expensive too,
yeah,
huh?
Well, exactly. Yeah. So I'm sprinting and I get there, and fortunately for some reason I see two other players that I know, but they didn't ask any questions while I was like dying and out of breath, and I just sort of slowly walked away wheeling my hand luggage with this TrackMan in that no one had touched, and I was just so grateful that it was still there.
A year ago, Callaway debuted their revolutionary ball speed technology, Jailbreak, in Epic Drivers. Golfers everywhere immediately noticed unbelievable gains, and as a result, it was somehow the best-selling driver every single month in 2017. I can speak from experience on this because I played the Epic all year long, and it was unquestionably the best club I've ever hit. You've definitely heard me say that on this podcast many times. Well, today, Callaway just unveiled their all-new Rogue drivers with enhanced Jailbreak technology for incredible distance and new, more forgiving head shapes. You can choose from three options: the Rogue Standard, which is a 460cc head that will benefit a wide range of players, and of course the Rogue Sub-Zero for golfers seeking extreme low spin and tour level shape. That's the one I'm going to be playing. And then of course you could have the Rogue Draw, which is, this is for golfers who are struggling with a slice and need every bit of draw promoting technology there is. As you can expect with Callaway, their content team is all over this, and they've built out an interactive landing page on their site that you must see. Go to callawaygolf.com/jailbreak for tech breakaparts, shaft options, videos, photos, it's everything. So callawaygolf.com/jailbreak, the new Rogue driver from Callaway, the number one driver in golf.
So are you pretty married to the TrackMan, or is, how often are you using it? Is it a key tool for you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's something more. Obviously, everyone knows that now. DJ's been just hammering his numbers. You know, obviously he's got this love affair apparently with this TrackMan. So
it's all they talk about. Yeah. On the coverage in the States.
it's become like a running meme. So
it's like DJ's friends with his TrackMan. Jordan and Justin are friends.
And that's it. That's all the media.
I like it. But yeah, I mean, it's more my fear of losing it than anything, I think.
That's why you're using it every day.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't even tell the best story. I just remembered the best story with the TrackMan. Left it in a rental car at JFK. I then got in a taxi with my girlfriend to go to LaGuardia. Got to LaGuardia, realized it's in the rental car JFK. Fortunately, flight's delayed. Get in a taxi, go back, pick it up, get back to LaGuardia, make my flight with the TrackMan. So
I'm not sure. I totally ever realized that you were responsible for buying your own TrackMan. Yeah. I just assumed TrackMan was like either just sponsored by the tours or they had representatives out there.
That'd be nicer. I wouldn't have to worry.
They bring technicians out to the tournaments, right?
Yeah,
and help you with it and everything.
Do,
okay,
yeah.
But it's fully operational on your own too, and you can hook it up to your
Absolutely,
phone.
Yeah.
So going back to, we started talking about the Masters going out of order here, but I want to know, was something like the first Masters you played in, what was something that surprised you?
I think just seeing the course itself, you know, you stand on top of, have you guys been before? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you stand the other side of the clubhouse, and I was there when it was just empty and there's just literally no one on the course, and you just don't realize how much, what's the word? Like elevation,
right?
That's the word.
That's the first thing.
How much
thing
elevation there is.
Number 10
you know,
is like a ski slope.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, like, literally, you stood at the top, and then you can see all the way down to, I want to say, 15 almost, kind of, maybe. But yeah, it's crazy.
So when you turned pro in 2014 after the U.S. Open, you bypassed your entry into the Open Championship as a U.S. amateur.
Yeah.
What made that timing make the most sense for you, or why that particular timing?
I'd qualified for the Open the year before, so I'd played the Open before. So that was, I think, if I hadn't have played that, I would have stayed and
because it's like one
played.
Month difference,
exactly,
right? Yeah,
exactly. But I think because I'd done it before, it was like. You know, there's a good run of events. There was Irish, Scottish, French. And then at the time, I'd managed to get invites for all of those. And it was good money opportunity, really. You know, you never know. You have three good starts there, three top tens, and you're close to getting your card. So.
And then you go straight to the Challenge Tour, kind of that second half of the
season,
right?
I'd not made enough money at the starts that I had and then got on Challenge Tour and sort of kicked on really fast and played really well and had some good finishes. So.
I've always been kind of, you know, we talked a lot of PGA Tour guys that come through the web and kind of the praises they sing for like that part of the process learning to be a professional. Was that Challenge Tour experience like pretty integral in your success, or were you kind of like ready to graduate pretty quickly?
A little bit. I think more the latter, really. You know, I think the courses aren't set up out there as they are here. You know, I'm good friends with David Lipsky. I've never played web.com, but Pat Goss told me a story about David calling him, doing, you know, you do all these drills on your dispersion and all this short game drills, and he rings Pat and says, all that shit you taught me is absolutely effing useless. You know, all these guys do is get driver out every hole, hit as far as they can,
make
fire every single flag and make every single putt, and that, like, this, what use is this to me? So I don't know whether it's like that I mean, on Challenge Tour, it wasn't that drastic, but I know you've got to shoot low scores.
There's more variables out there too with the conditioning. So, how many Challenge Tour events did you play?
I think I played eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the craziest place you played? Because like we've got a friend back in Jacksonville, Chris Baker, who he played the Challenge Tour 1 year, I think, and he was telling us about going to the Kazakhstan Open. Yeah,
I played two. The two best were I went to Azerbaijan.
Okay.
Which was just in the middle of nowhere, the weirdest place ever. This hotel called the Rixos Hotel, and it was like brand new, amazing build, just empty. Like there was like just about 40 golfers staying in there or whatever it was. And then went to Kazakhstan, and that was interesting to say the least.
A handful of golf courses in the whole country.
Exactly. We kept having this guy who looked like a drug dealer or something. He just kept coming up to us in a leather jacket, gold teeth, shaking my hand, like pretty much it was like every other day, and he's like, "You play well today. You play well." And I like just so strange. And yeah, that was interesting.
I remember watching you, Big Randy, one of our other guys, and I, we always went down to the Heritage every year. And I remember watching you 1 year, we probably watched you for 25 minutes, just hit balls. And we're like, man, he has the best tempo in his swing ever. But you didn't try to overswing it. You didn't try to, I mean, is that kind of something that you've always had, or is that something?
One problem I'm trying to work on the range like this year is I just literally drag a ball hit. And like, it's far too quick. So I don't think I always take in what I'm being told by my coach, whatever. And, you know, like you say, tempo sort of goes, then before you know it, you're just hitting one after another. And I've always tried to sort of keep my, when I overswing a little bit, it doesn't really help me at all. So that's another thing, really. So it's just like almost try and swing within myself, nice and slow and easy, and keep it short. So
was it tough when you're paired up with somebody like a Dustin Johnson or Alvaro Quiroz or something like that to not overswing?
Do you know what? It's not as bad as I thought. You know, I always thought I probably would try and go after it. But I think, like, what I like to think is that I make it up for it in other areas. You know, I know a lot of people say, you know, oh, you hole every putt you look at. And I do putt well, you know, statistically I do. So I'd like to just try and keep that in my mind that, you know, just output him rather than out drive him.
At what point in 2016 did you start thinking about Ryder Cup qualification?
Every week. Yeah. Every week.
It's that big
every
a deal?
Every week, yeah. You know, like, I end the season, I won the second week of the points. You know, didn't think anything of it. Like, anyway, then have, like, three top tens at the end of the year in big events, so I'm still up there. And then gets to about, I don't know, February or March. Yeah, probably just after April. And it's like, hang on, like, I'm in for getting the Ryder Cup team here. And then all of a sudden it just became really real. And then every week was like beating myself up, like, oh, I've got to do well, got to make that team, And, you know, I was having big discussions with my coach about it. And and the first week where we sort of had a sit down and said, you know, look, you've got to just let it go. You know, you just got to play and relax. I ended up winning the Nordea Masters. So that helped again. It helped me kick along again. And then, when I did close it out, it was such a great feeling, you know.
How would you describe your first Ryder Cup experience?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
You can let it fly.
Yeah, I am going to let it fly.
As he looks over to his manager.
It was brilliant, but disappointing.
Yeah.
Did
you know you were going to sit out the first day, or was that a surprise when it happened?
It's one of those. I kind of went in thinking I was going to sit out one. I didn't expect to sit out three, personally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand where it was all coming from. Rookie, not played it before, American turf, all that. But I think the whole thing with it, you know, we never really got a chance. Like me, Chris Wood, Andy Sullivan, and, you know, it would have been nice to just have a chance. The one thing I learned from it was you need to play four ball. You need to play one of the four ball matches before going to Sunday. That would be my opinion, purely just to play your own ball, just to hole out, you know.
But hit every shot.
Just a bit of pressure. Like, I played a foursomes on Saturday. I've hit probably, well, half the shots, obviously, and like, I'm just not ready to go. You know, I don't know what it's like to hold a 6-footer. It's
right.
You know, it's just weird. It's really weird.
Do you think the 0-4 start in the first session changed kind of the plan for any of the pairings or anything?
No, I think Danny Willett's brother changed the things. I really do. You know,
yeah.
If he doesn't write the article, Danny probably plays. You know, Darren's got his ideas. I don't know if the UX team were more excited to play or not, but maybe they're not so excited to play. And I think I think it might have been 3-1, you know, maybe 2-all, whatever. But I think they might have had a chance in the afternoon to play, you know.
Yeah, because sitting Willett let the crowd get even more fired up for when he actually came out.
Well, exactly.
And it was ugly. It was terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, I was out there just in some of those situations, and you're in no position as a media member to say something, but I almost turned around and be like, stop.
Yeah.
This is golf, you people.
Yeah. Damn you people, this is golf. It was like legitimately ugly. And that was kind of like, I was living abroad at the time, and I came back to the States and kind of just looked around like in like a changing political environment. Yeah, yeah. I was like, this is just weird. I mean, it was kind of like a, I don't know. It didn't fill me with like patriotic pride the way people conducted themselves. And
what was like the craziest thing somebody said to you or the?
I had a few. Yeah, I had a few. I had
anything that's suitable for
my first day. My first hole. Get to the green. Did your mum cut your hair? That was a good one. I thought that was a good one.
That's kind of good.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was good. And then that afternoon, I think I was eating a sandwich. Did your mum cut your crust off that? That was a good one as well.
You were 21 at the time?
Yeah. So, I mean...
It works.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Those are healthy signs.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, it's better than some of the stuff that some of the guys got, obviously. But
we want to know what was the worst taunt you got or the worst...
Those were the worst. I got off lightly. Yeah, exactly. I think... In my opinion, I mean, I followed Dan because I'm good friends with him, and I followed a few of the other boys that get a little bit more stick than the most, and like obviously it came across badly in the media, but I really didn't think it was that bad. I don't know whether people didn't expect it to be that bad or what, but I went in there with the full mindset that every single one of those fans hates you, wants to destroy you, and you just got to deal with it. I think maybe my soccer background helped a little.
I was going to say being English.
Yeah, I really do, because
soccer hooligans.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I my team Sheffield United, I've been to so many games, and you know, you see it all the time. Their player misses the ball or whatever, does a bad tackle, and all of a sudden the fans are saying everything under the sun and just abusing the guy. So I'm not saying I was used to it, but, you know, I've heard it before.
Rory said in his presser today just how little the course and the setup did favors for you guys as the European team, which I suppose is part of the plan as a host. But
absolutely.
But how different it's going to be in France this year as well. So going back to Hazeltine, I mean, probably just not your cup of tea as far as a course is concerned.
No, absolutely. And I think my caddy... saw Davis maybe the Sunday or something, or the Saturday, and Davis said, how do you like it? My caddy was like, well, set up for you boys and or something like that, and he was like, yep, absolutely. So he admitted to it, you know.
It's no secret.
And it's rightly so. Like, why wouldn't you set up? You want to win. The aim of the game is to win, and it's not cheating. It's just a request. So
it's funny. Rose called it the setup on Sunday. Said it was similar to a pro-am.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, and I mean, I can't remember too much of the Sunday, but like the flags, I seem to remember pretty central.
Yeah,
not tucked really.
It's a pretty polarizing course as it is.
Tony Jacklin said it's like a cow patch or cow field or something like that, and that's not really what you want said about your golf course.
And then Waiyang. I mean, I have bad memories because Waiyang.
Go did to Tiger.
Did a tiger.
Never forgive him for that.
Yeah.
What was it like to get paired with a guy like Henrik Stenson and a veteran? Did he say anything in particular to you before you started and during the round about nerves, anything like that?
I think not really. I mean, I know his caddy as well, and obviously he's worked with Pete for such a long time, so we kind of had a bit of a pre-existing relationship, which was good. He's quite a quiet person anyway, so I don't really think he didn't really say much. And for me, yeah, don't get me wrong, I was nervous, but I kind of put things into perspective. Like, I'm not going to hit like amazing shots in my first ever Ryder Cup, so, you know, I kind of just sort of tried to deal with it as best I could. But you know, he's a good partner to have, because I think the thing is, you know, he's so good tee to green. I sort of had that confidence, like, oh, it's all right, Henrik will save it. I can hit it anywhere. He'll just get it on the green. That's fine.
And he keeps it pretty light
out there. Yeah, well, exactly.
Were the nerves as real as everyone says they are, or was it?
Yes and no, yeah. The first, it was more, I think, excitement nerves rather than like, oh, God, this could go anywhere. Like, it was just, you just wanted to get going because it was just and make putts and sort of fist bump and all that sort of stuff that comes with it. You know, I remember watching Medina, and, you know, you're just there like, oh, I want to be part of that, and I've never thought I would be in 4 years' time. So,
in hearing Rory's comments at the press conference today, it seems like you guys are pretty fired up for a rematch.
I think so. Yeah, I genuinely do. I think
chomping at the bit to kind of respond to some of the
hopefully
confidence.
All being well, like, I'd love to make the team. Like, that is my main goal this year, and you know, I think we will have a strong team, but you kind of do want a bit of revenge, you know. I want for me personally as well, playing two matches out of five was really disappointing for me, bearing in mind one's mandatory. So I kind of just want to get another crack at it, really, because I don't feel I was given enough chance. Like, I almost want to sort of say, look, can we just not count that one on my records, you know?
As a warm-up.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the scouting report on Le Golf National?
Don't know if I can share that.
Just from a venue perspective, like seeing it on TV, it almost looks kind of like TPC Sawgrass or something. No, it's tight, and there's water, and just
do you know, when I first ever played there, it was my first event, or one of my first events as a pro. I loved it. The fairways were lined with gorse, and it was really tight. Rough was thick, firm greens. And then, obviously, when they found out the Ryder Cup was coming, they changed it, and they took it all away. And I've played the French Open last year, and I was like, this is awful. Like, terrible, because it's just wide open, and, you know.
They're totally playing into the American
team. Yeah, well, exactly, right? So I'm thinking, It was terrible because they'd taken all, but every single hole pretty much like has a bank either side. Mm-hmm. So literally every hole will be like a stadium, and that's what's going to be amazing. And you know why they've done it. You can see it. But when you get those holes filled with people, it's going to be unbelievable. I think it will probably be one of the best, like, as a venue, I think, for crowd anyway.
Eurasia Cup. How was that?
It was good fun. Yeah. It was, a little trickier than everyone thought, I think. Yeah, I personally thought they were underrated. I thought they were going to be better than what everyone said.
So that's an event in the States where not a whole lot of people. I remember watching it a few years ago.
Yeah,
and like
doesn't get much coverage.
People had no idea what it was. Mm. Which I think they should move it around either in Asia, you know, just in Asia to kind of grow the game over there, but also just to get it more exposure in the States. But how was the course over there in Kuala Lumpur?
The course is, I mean, it's like a bit of a resort course. Mm-hmm. It's pretty wide open, but at the same time, the rough's not very, it's pretty nasty too. Like, it's quite thick. But, you know, if you hit a 60-yard right wide drive,
you're still in play.
You know, you're still in play, yeah. You know, I played a couple of guys that did that, and all right, they hack it up by the green and they get up and down because they know the grass so well and they're so good at chipping, you know. But if you took it round another golf course, you're losing four balls and you're winning holes. And that, I had a good conversation with Alex Norren on the Sunday. We're talking about the golf course and why it was a bit closer and stuff. And we're used to playing golf courses where they took the pins and it's three from the right and we had a good shot and it's 15 feet. You know, you're not always going to make your 15 footers, but those guys miss the green and then they're so good at chipping, they just chip it on and hold the putt. Mm-hmm. So that I think that's why they probably had a bit of an advantage.
So you flew here from Malaysia?
Yes.
And then where were you before that?
Dubai for a couple of days. Okay. And then before that, I was in Florida.
Okay. And Florida's home base for you, at least right now?
It is now, yeah. Yeah, it okay. is now, yeah.
How did you decide on Florida? Just
the Bears Club.
Yeah, it speaks for itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for me, sort of being at home, like my practice facilities are non-existent, you know. There's no... Bears Club has a par 3 course, it has double-sided range, two chipping greens, two putting greens, it's...
Good weather.
Just, I mean, yeah, perfect weather, yeah. I mean, it's brilliant, you know, yeah. And...
You can fly in and out pretty easily,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's not too bad in that aspect, and... But the thing is, with it, you've got Rory, you've got Justin Thomas, you've got Ricky, you've got mm-hmm. all these guys playing there where I'd love to go play nine holes with them, either to pick the brains or to just compete against them just to get me sharper. And
not only is there always a game, there's always a game with a top
top player exactly in the world. Exactly. It's not like you're just going to go play with three friends that are off like 6, 7, and 8, you know.
So living in Florida now, or at least part-time, how do you set your schedule up? Like, do you play kind of the Florida swing and then stack those WGCs and then kind of come back over to Europe?
Yeah, so I'm doing February basically till end of May. And then I'll go back and forth a bit in between after that. But I'm in America basically from February till May. And then I've got a month off basically in February.
Okay.
And then I'll play Mexico, Valspar, Bay Hill match play.
Okay.
So
cool. And then as far as the tournaments that you've won prior, do those kind of dictate what your schedule is moving forward? Like, I know you won the Nordea Masters 2016, like just boat race to
field. Yeah, a little bit, but you know, it is like I've sort of taken the view now really that I want to play where I want to play or where I need to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's my dad being knowing all the stuff about world ranking points. There's going to be occasions over the next few years where we go try play like Japan Open or because there's certain events that carry like national opens carry more ranking points. So kind of you're not cheating the system, but they're not going to have a stronger field as
you're preaching this to the choir
week,
here, you know? Solly. This is like Solly's
really.
He's up on a pedestal just preaching this.
You tricky Europeans manipulating the official world golf rankings. That's what so many people have been saying. Like, oh, look at the world golf rankings. Europe's going to be favored in the Ryder Cup, and I'm like, Euros are manipulating the system. And you just admitted it. You're making me so happy.
Like, yeah, but so, not everyone does it though. Like not everyone. No offense to everyone
season.
Else.
Yeah.
But they're not as smart. Like
that fall
not that
part
smart.
Of the season, like, is where the Euros like make a huge put because you guys have more events.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of the year,
ton of
that
events,
makes sense.
Ton
yeah,
of points
yeah.
and stuff like that. It's yeah. not necessarily manipulation, but it is like end of the year rankings, which decides where you get into some events for the next year.
Yeah,
it's
that
like
is very
a
true.
Strong Europe push.
Solly's still salty that Alex Noren was like ninth in the world.
It's a separate topic. But,
hey, he won four times in a year.
I know.
You've got to give it credit to him. And the four that he won were good four.
They
events.
Were. They totally were. The knock was never on Noren. It's just like the way the rankings work.
Just
like
the tournaments.
Yeah. No. It's just like if you win a bunch, and it's not the best case, but the point is, like, if you win a bunch of events, like on the European Tour, you can get, like, if you get. I think there was one week where, you know, you win, you get 24 points or something like that. And somebody finished a shot out of the playoff in like the Valspar. I remember this. And they got like 4 points and because they finished like tied fourth because
yeah.
it was a 3-way tie. And like, so with a much, much better field, yeah. you get so many less points.
No, I agree. And I mean, I know Grace and Maureen, Kelly Kraft, mm-hmm. were on? Yeah, they were on the bandwagon of this, which
right.
I understand. And, you know, I do.
For
agree.
The record, I'm on your side.
No, I agree. Like the fields here are probably, you know, we get like this week's a great example. DJ comes over, Rosie comes over, Rory's here. All of a sudden, the points are just pumped up, you know. So it only takes a European to have a good week, finishes second, picks up, I don't know, say 20 ranking points, and he's just flying. He's flying up there, you know. Right. Whereas,
but there's value in if you
every week in the US though has Ricky, DJ, Justin, you know, Spieth, all those boys.
That's the thing, is if you're beating a huge sum of some of the top players, there should be a ton of value in that. Yeah. If you win a lower ranked European Tour event that may not have anyone from the top 100 in the world, you get a ton of points no matter what. That's kind of my argument. It's always been, but it's, I don't know, when you're just kind of splitting hairs when you get into that top mess. It's, there's not, the world rankings aren't like holding anybody in particular back. I mean, there's, it's just kind of simply, it's not perfect.
The company I use for stats, they have like a performance ranking, so they like do it a little bit different, and like literally mine has been worse than my official world ranking, and that they've got a lot of guys that are that, and there's very few that are better than the world ranking. So,
well, I wouldn't mind it if, you know, there's, you know, Koepka and Uline, those guys, like the American guys that have kind of bypassed playing the web tour to go play in Europe. I think that's fantastic. I think that's great for you.
I think that's smarter. And you know, I think you probably learn a bit more.
Yeah, it makes a little more sense. I'm getting near the end of my questions. You got any more?
All right, defending in Sweden, you came in second. Was that, what was that experience like? Just, I mean, had you kind of cracked the code on defending? I know that's just kind of,
I wish,
just kind of looking at what all Fleetwood had to do today was remarkable. Like all the obligations and everything was just wild. You know, he was just being ferried around from place to place to place. Today.
I think it depends on the thing. Like even DP World's the biggest one I won, and even defending that last year,
that's Dubai, right?
Yeah. Even defending that last year, that wasn't, it wasn't that bad. I think it depends on which tournament.
And some of that
win.
Today too was probably he got the Player of the Year award.
Exactly. But I know British Masters the year after won that. That was pretty busy. You know, he got a lot of interviews, got to play this and the pro am and do this thing, and that was pretty busy. But you know, I think you'd be an idiot to complain that you got to do all that. You know, I'd take winning every year and having to do that the following year, you know. But it is, I don't know if in Europe the guys have to do more than they do in America. It seems that way when I'm over there. But I don't know if that's actually the case.
Favorite course in England?
Oh, favorite course in England? Probably Woburn.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I won around there, but I just really like his tree line. It reminds me a lot of Harbour Town.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd probably go with that.
I was gonna say, I think you're bound to win Harbour Town.
Honestly, if I won Harbour Town, I may retire. Yeah, that has always been the goal. Like growing up, we were there on holiday all the time. We'd always watch the tournament. And then
such
to play
a great
in it,
week.
Oh,
so
I love
back,
it. And to miss the cut these last 2 years as a pro, like, I'm so angry.
Do you think you've gotten almost too excited for it?
Maybe. I really think the Masters takes it a lot out of you. Mm-hmm. I think certainly the year after I finished seventh, sort of I got to Harbour Town, and I was like, almost, do I have to play? And then I was like, it doesn't matter if I miss the cut here, which is not really a great way, obviously, looking at it, but it's kind of just that Masters buzz, you still are coming off that, and you're a bit like, I could, it's better
now,
to have a week off.
But
all, at the same time, like, I love the event so much, I would almost never miss it, really.
You're going to start skipping the Masters
to
prep for Harbour
Town.
Win,
yeah. Absolutely. No, that's a lie. Anyone from the Masters is listening.
Have you always kind of looked up to Luke Donald as a mentor? Like, was that part of going to...
Not really, no. Really? Like, I respect Luke a lot. Mm-hmm. He's been a great player. He still is a great player. And but...
Who's kind of taking you under their wing the most?
I mean, probably more because... I admired him from afar as Martin Keimer, really.
Really?
I've just become really good friends with Martin, and, you know, he's a 2-time major winner, and I think people forget that a lot. He's a great guy, works really, really hard, and he's very, very genuine. You know, I've met a lot of these guys, and, you know, you play rounds with them on the golf course, and then you'll see him after, and it's like you won't get anything out of them, really. And
He seems like he has a life.
Yeah,
off the course
he does.
Well.
He does. And he's just a really good guy. He's looking to it for a girlfriend at the minute. If anyone's listening, so you know.
Last time you paid for a round of golf. This always gets everybody. Yeah.
I know the answer to this, though. The only one I can really think of is like the West Palm Beach par 3 that I played like 2 Christmases ago.
Okay.
That's the only one I can really think of.
What tournament in the States have you not played yet that you really want to get to?
Memorial.
Okay.
Absolutely. Good answer. Yeah. Memorial.
This is, you're talking to.
Absolutely.
I'm from Dublin, Ohio.
So oh, okay.
That was music
yeah.
to my ears. So, all right. I think on that, we're going to wrap it up. All thank right, you, Mike. Thank you for, Tron and I had to share a microphone in this one because we had some technical issues. If you couldn't tell, I waited till the end to say it because I didn't want people to notice it until then. But, Matt, thank you for the time and, best of luck this week. There is actually a well-known No Laying Up podcast bump for the week that you do the interview.
Oh.
So actually I had some people messaging me this week saying, who am I interviewing this week? Because they want to bet on you. So a lot of people are right, going to be placing perfect. Bets on you to
I
win
hope,
this week.
I hope so. I hope it works out.
One last question. How much of a menace is Kiradek Apibonrat? Like he just looked like he was tearing it up in the team rooms this week and like
well, it's
just vaping all over the place.
It's funny. I mean, he's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
He made a little bit of a mistake last week, but putting up first out, first point against Paul Casey and Fleetwood, I think. And you don't want to get
just
PC mad. You don't want to get Paul Casey fired up. Not all. So that didn't end well.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. I just had to ask.
No.
Yeah.
No.
All right. We'll wrap it at that. Thank you for the time, man. And best
no
of
problem.
Luck this week. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Johnny, that's better than most. How about him? That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?